You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores. Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Epochs! Hello and welcome back to Epochs. If you remember last time, we left off on the eve of the Battle of Agincourt, St. Crispin's Day, the 25th of October, 1415. So we'll pick up right there. I did promise to read from more than one source this time, but however, I will pick up once again with Ian Mortimer, and then we'll move on to different accounts. First thing to say is that despite the amount of evidence we've got, I've said a number of times in this series, haven't I, that we're actually blessed with quite a lot of information. It's still the 15th century, early 15th century, so it's not, you know, completely in the light of history as we might like. I mean, it is completely in the light of history, but, you know, we're not flooded with sources. One of the things to say about the Battle of Agincourt is that even though there are accounts from both sides, it's not sort of a perfect picture we've got. In fact, it's far from a perfect picture. And that's one of the things why I want to read from multiple different sources in this episode and maybe the next episode, is to show that different historians have got different ideas about exactly what happened. I mean, if we just talk about the archaeology very briefly, the battlefield where people always thought, always said the Battle of Agincourt took place. In recent years, archaeologists have shown that it's almost certainly not the battlefield. The battlefield must be in that area. It must be nearby. But the actual field that historians thought was Agincourt, there's like not really any bodies there. There's hardly any arrowheads. It's sort of clearly not a battlefield. So we've got it in slightly the wrong place. And yeah, the accounts differ on exactly how the battle itself went down, the exact details, the exact chronology of what happened in what order. So although we've got a reasonable idea of what happened that day, the Feast of St. Crispin's, there is still some grey area. So let's get into it. Again, the day before, on the night before the battle, I mean, if you know your Shakespeare, there's a great scene in Shakespeare where the night before the French are all sort of drinking and whooping it up and having a good time because they're pretty convinced they're going to win on the morrow. They're finally going to smash the dreaded English up because they've got them outnumbered. They've got them cornered. The English are suffering from dysentery. They haven't got many knights, mounted knights. They haven't even got relatively that many men at arms. It's just a bunch of archers that are outnumbered with low morale and dysentery. So the French feel like tomorrow is their big day, and it's sort of a slam dunk. It's a fait accompli. And the English, for their part, are sort of terribly worried and saying that, literally saying their prayers, expecting to get slaughtered when the sun comes up in the morning. And Shakespeare has a great scene where good King Hal, warlike Harry, goes round the camp and sometimes not making it clear it's him, but other times sort of instilling people with the spirit to fight on, you know, never give up, all that sort of thing. But I won't go on too much about Shakespeare because I'm more interested in the actual history. So let's pick up from Thursday with Ian Mortimer. Let's pick up on Thursday the 24th, i.e. the eve of the battle. Ian Mortimer tells us this, quote, "The English crossed the River Conch this morning and proceeded directly northwards toward Blangy, where they would cross the River Ternoise. The Duke of York and the whole of the vanguard was ahead, clearing a way for the English army. The French were in the same area. Advanced English troops regularly came under attack from squadrons of French men-at-arms. Seven Lancashire archers were captured in one engagement. It was becoming clear that both sides were racing for the Ternoise, and if the French stopped them crossing, there would be a battle, with no safe retreat for the English. There was no time to go looking for food. Although most of the troops had not eaten properly for several days and were growing weaker all the time, their hopes of survival rested on speed and avoiding a pitched battle with the better fed, better equipped and more numerous French men-at-arms." Again, in Shakespeare, we have the English top brass complaining that the French are all fresh. Not only are we outnumbered, but they're well fed and ready to rock and roll, and we're on our last legs. Mortimer continues here. "Henry himself was nervous, distracted. Along the route to Blangy, he was told that his herbergers had identified a place in a particular village where he could eat and briefly rest. But he continued, ignorant of where the town was. When informed that he had ridden a mile and a half past it, he refused to go back, explaining he was in his coat armour and it would not do for him to turn up at a village when dressed for war. He could have added that he did not have time. So he rode on, taking the main battle of the army with him, and ordered the Duke of York to lead the vanguard further ahead. When the Duke of York came to the hill overlooking Blangy, he saw French troops desperately trying to destroy the bridge. Immediately he attacked and fought the men-at-arms there, killing some and taking others prisoner. Having secured the bridge, he sent scouts up the hill on the far side. One returned with a worried face and anxious, gasping breath, and announced to the Duke that a great countless multitude was approaching. Another account states that the scouts who first spotted the French, quote, being astonished at the size of the French army, returned to the Duke with a trembling heart, as fast as his horse would carry him. Almost out of breath, he said, be prepared quickly for battle, for you are about to fight against such a huge host that it cannot be numbered, end quote. Mortimer continues. Soon other scouts returned and confirmed this sighting. The Duke reported the locations to the king. So it's becoming more and more clear that Henry and his men are in fact cornered, despite the fact that they were able to get across the Somme, i.e. on the right side of the Somme to Calais, their ultimate destination and chance of hope of getting home. They're still basically cornered between two French armies. It's seeming more and more clear. Henry's running out, or the English army is running out of escape routes. They're sort of getting more and more cut off and surrounded, painted into a corner. There was 12 miles to Blangy-sur-Ternoise, so the valley must have come in Henry's sight about noon or a little later. The author of the Gesta, i.e. a contemporary history, notes that the main battle caught their first sight of the enemy here. They were emerging further up the valley to the right. The English crossed the Ternoise and climbed rapidly up the hill on the far side. And when they reached the brow of the hill, they were suddenly confronted by the French army. In describing the moment, the author of the Gesta uses the words grim-looking to describe the French. It was not their expressions to which he was referring. He could not see their faces. And this is a quote from the Gesta, which says, their numbers were so great as to not even be comparable with ours, filling a very broad field like a swarm of countless locusts. And then it's Mortimer continues. It was a sentiment echoed by every writer on the English side and very probably every man in Henry's army. So it doesn't look good. That's one of the things that keeps coming up, always comes up whenever anyone ever really talks about the Battle of Ashley. How outnumbered were the English? So there's no doubt, there's literally no doubt in anyone's mind that the English were outnumbered. It's just a case of whether they were outnumbered 2-1, 3-1, 6-1, 20-1. I will quote from different historians. They all seem to have a slightly different take on it. From everything I know, and from everything I've read over the years, it seems to me it was at least 3 or 4 to 1, maybe as much as 5 or 6 to 1. I feel like probably anything more than that would be an exaggeration. Some of the more technical historians get into the fact that there simply wasn't enough room in the countryside for it to be much more than that. You know, it just seems unlikely that the English were outnumbered 20 to 1 or, you know, 60 to 1 seems crazy. I mean, sort of physically not possible, not likely. But, you know, 2, 3, 4 to 1, certainly. I mean, maybe more. I wouldn't be surprised if it was like 6 to 1. We don't know exactly because the French numbers are never clear. We know almost exactly how many English soldiers there were, and we'll get into all this later when we get onto the battle itself, because it was all documented. But on the French side, because there were so many men pouring in, even on the day of the battle, we just don't know. And their chroniclers never kept like a roll of exactly who was there that day. So we just don't know. But anyway, I'm sure I'll talk about that more as we go on. Ian Mortimer continues. This brings us to a most important question. As the army ascended the hill from Blangy to Maisoncelles and looked for the first time across the field of Agincourt, what did they really see? How many men were there this afternoon? Were the English truly outnumbered 30 to 1, as the author of The Gesta relates, or 6 to 1, as Jean de Warren claimed, or 3 to 1, as reported by the French chronicler Lefebvre? Also to say here, after the battle, it's, you know, sort of in the French interests to make it out that they didn't have such a fantastic advantage. You know, it's more embarrassing to lose a battle if you're outnumbering your enemy 30 to 1. You know, if it was only 3 to 1, it's a bit less embarrassing. And of course, on the English side, it's much more glorious to have won a battle where you were outnumbered 6 to 1 as opposed to 3 to 1. So who knows? Bit of propaganda on both sides. We do know the English numbers. Anyway, Mortimer continues saying, or the 3 to 1 as reported by the French chronicler Lefebvre, who was actually in the English army at the time, or 3 or 4 to 1 as the French monk of St. Denis stated. Or did the French outnumber the English just 3 to 2, as the chronicle written by a Parisian cleric said? As shown in Appendix 4, and now Ian Mortimer lays his cards on the table and tells you what he thinks the answer is, and once again, other historians, eminent historians, serious historians, will disagree with what he says here. So this is Ian Mortimer's opinion, although he states it firmly. He says, the actual ratio of Frenchmen to Englishmen at the battle cannot have been more than 2 to 1. Indeed, it was probably slightly less than that. The English army of between 8,000 and 9,000 fighting men found themselves facing between 12,000 and 15,000 Frenchmen. There simply is no evidence to support a larger French army. Well, more men did stream in all during the next day, so there's that at least, Ian. Anyway, those who have opted to maintain the vast disparity mentioned in chronicles, like the Gesta, have done so largely because of national pride and tradition, not because of a body of supporting evidence. On the other hand, those who have sought to correct such views have themselves failed to answer a crucial question arising from their revisionism. Why were the English astonished as they climbed the hill above Blangy and saw the French army? Or, to put it another way, why do so many chronicles on both sides agree that the French hugely outnumbered the English? Yeah, good question. The most likely answer, says Mortimer, which has not been put forward before, lies in the different makeup of the two armies and the numbers of their respective non-combatants. English companies had 30 archers to every 10 men-at-arms, and thus only 10 pages, an extra 25% of non-combatants. In the French army, for every 30 archers, there were 60 men-at-arms, and thus 60 pages, an extra 66% of non-combatants. Whereas the English had about 1,500 pages, the French had between 8 and 10,000. In addition, all the men-at-arms on both sides would have had spare horses, and the easiest and safest way to move those was to allow the pages to ride them. From a distance of 3 or 4 miles, it would have been very difficult to distinguish between the men-at-arms and the pages. So when the French looked at the English army, they saw no more than 11,000 men in total, 8,000 to 9,000 fighting men, plus the pages and support staff. But when the English looked at the French army, they saw at least 18,000 mounted men, not including the 4,000 or 5,000 archers and crossbowmen, and the extra infantry raised from the locality. If there were 10,000 men-at-arms, as the Burgundian chroniclers and Julie suggest, then the English probably really did see an army about 3 times the size of their own fighting force, which I think is a fair point for him to make. I still don't think it necessarily completely answers the question that Ian Mortimer himself posed there. Why do so many of the chroniclers state it so forcefully that the English were so outnumbered? I mean, it's a good explanation. It's a fair explanation to me. But, you know, does that cover it? Does that really answer it? I mean, that explanation relies on the fact that the pages were all riding horses and that the English couldn't tell the difference between a page and a knight. Why would the pages be riding the horses around? And even at a distance, the trained eye would know the difference between an actual knight and a page, I would have thought. Anyway, it's not a bad explanation. Still, he continues saying, from the point of view of the French, another factor has to be considered. The prejudice against low-status archers. French archers had won no major battles and had contributed very little to French military prestige over the centuries. Crossbowmen employed in French wars were often mercenaries, and the French saw their archers as relatively insignificant. Also, crossbows were slow and weak in battle. It is unlikely that many Frenchmen knew how destructive a coordinated mass of English longbows could be. That's strange, because we've already had the Battle of Tours and Crecy, where exactly that happened. I always think that's odd when historians say, at Agincourt, the French didn't know how dangerous the English longbow was. I don't buy that, because they did know. They must have known. Again, there's been the Battle of Crecy and Tours, or Poitiers, the Battle of Poitiers, the Black Prince. So they did know. So don't tell me that. The most that any of them had faced in living memory, oh, actually, that's fair, might not be in living memory. Still, it had happened, and, you know, information does get passed down through more than one generation. The most that any of them had faced in living memory was 1,000 or so archers at St. Cloud in 1411. For the English, on the other hand, the archers were crucial. So, while 8,000 English soldiers came to terms with the prospect of fighting what appeared to be an army of 24,000 or more Frenchmen, 3-1, the French saw that their own men-at-arms outnumbered the English men-at-arms 6-1. The contemporary chronicler, Edmund de Dynton, adopted this form of reckoning. There were 10 French nobles against one English, he stated, slightly exaggerating. The social prejudices of the French military elite, in addition to variations in the two kingdoms' military traditions, meant that both sides thought that the French army outnumbered the English heavily, whether 3-1 or 6-1. The feeling the English had of being outnumbered 3-1 was exaggerated by the fact that they could not see the whole of the French force. They knew the size of their own army, of course, having marched in 3 battles and camped together for the last 3 weeks, but for them, the whole of the surrounding area might have been populated with French troops. The villages could not be presumed to be unoccupied. A large number of scouts had attacked French troops at villages and river crossings. The very nature of the medieval landscape meant that coppices, barns and houses obscured the forces of the defending army. On top of this, both sides would have been aware that not all the French troops had yet arrived. It seems the Count of Nevers was not actually with the French army at this stage. It is possible that his men-at-arms had delayed at Corbie and had been the cavalry whom the English had seen at Peronne on the 19th. Certainly his brother, the Duke of Brabant, was still hurrying to the army, staying at Lens this evening, 30 miles away. The Duke of Brittany was still at Amiens, although he had sent ahead his brother, the Count of Richemont, with some of his men. The Duke of Anjou's 600 men-at-arms also had not yet arrived, being led by the Seigneur de Longhi. The commander of the Parisian garrison, Tenugai du Castel, who was also in the battle plan, was also absent. Even the newly appointed overall commander of the French forces, the Duke of Orléans, was not yet with the army. For the already outnumbered English, the prospect of becoming more heavily outnumbered on the following day can only have demoralised them further. Yeah, no, absolutely. All during the night and the following morning, just more and more French forces kept flooding in. So it's in Henry's interest. When he realises he has to fight a pitched battle, he wants it as soon as possible. It's almost as though every minute that goes by the following day, the day of the battle, his position becomes ever more dangerous. So he doesn't want to just play for time. If we're going to do this, the sooner the better, from the English point of view. I mean, the Duke of Brabant turns up really late. You know, it's late in the day, the next day, before he turns up. So, yeah, the French are swelling their numbers kind of constantly. Mortimer continues, Henry's reaction to the news that a huge army lay ahead of him was to set spurs to his horse and ride ahead to join the Duke of York. Having seen the French army for himself, he returned to the main battle and, quote, very calmly and quite heedlessly of danger, he gave encouragement to his army and drew them up in battle and wings as if they were to fight immediately. The troops began to make their confessions. They knelt and prayed, you know, because the battle might happen on this day. We know it isn't until the following day. But, you know, if the French had forced the issue, there could have been a battle on the 24th. Could have been forced to battle almost any moment if the French had taken the initiative. But, you know, we know they don't. Anyway, according to some reports, it was at this juncture that Sir Walter Hungerford said to Henry that he wished that they had another 10,000 of the finest archers in England. According to the Gesta, Henry replied, "That is a foolish way to talk, because by God in heaven, upon whose grace I have relied, and in whom is my first hope of victory, even if I could, I would not have one man more than I do. For these men with me are God's people, whom he deigns to let me have at this time. Do you not believe that the Almighty, with these humble few, is able to overcome the opposing arrogance of the French, who boast of their great number and their own strength?" Another source has Henry, Mortimer speaking again. Another source has Henry replying less lyrically to a request by Hungerford for just 1,000 more archers. And according to this source, he's supposed to have said, "Thus, foolish one, do you tempt God with evil? My hope does not wish for one man more. Victory is not seen to be given on the basis of numbers. God is all-powerful. My cause is put into his hands. Here he pressed us down with disease. Being merciful, he will not let us be killed by these enemies. Let pious prayers be offered to him." Now there, of course, we can see the seeds of the famous St. Crispin's Day speech in Shakespeare's play, Henry V. Shakespeare, you would have thought, has almost certainly read those accounts and, you know, makes up his own speech vaguely based on that. And I'll talk about that in a moment. Just to finish up here, Ian Mortimer says, "Did such a conversation take place? Other chroniclers do mention it, but in very similar words. All the accounts might have been based on a story circulating in the wake of the Gesta. The authors were writing with the benefit of hindsight and keen to expand on the religious virtues of the king. But even if the story is true and verbatim, it was not wholly original. It has several precedents in biblical speeches attributed to Judas Maccabeus, the Old Testament king of whom Edward III had been compared and with whom Henry's father had associated himself. For example, in Maccabees 3, verses 16 to 19, one reads, "When he reached the city of Beth Horon, Judas went out to meet him with a few men. But when they saw the army coming against them, they said to Judas, 'How can we, few as we are, fight against such a mighty host as this? Besides, we are weak today from fasting.' But Judas said, 'It is easy for many to be overcome by a few. In the sight of heaven, there is no difference between deliverance by many or a few. For victory in war does not depend upon the size of the army, but on the strength that comes from heaven.'" Now, Ian Mortimer again. "Other speeches are to be found in the various chronicles for the evening. But these two are of uncertain veracity and written with the benefit of hindsight. Henry supposedly made a speech in which he declared that he would rather die than be taken by the enemy. He might have done, he might not. Similarly, some French chronicles state that Henry sent heralds to the French asking that the battle be put off until the following day. As not all the French had arrived, such a plan suited them well. If Henry did seek a short truce, he did not trust the answer. He kept his troops drawn up in battle formation until sunset, and for much of the time he made them kneel and pray. Only when it was clear that there would be no pitched battle did he tell them to take shelter for the night in the houses, gardens and orchards of Maisoncelles. It was then that it began to rain." End quote. So before I go on, I just want to mention the famous St. Crispin's Day speech in Shakespeare. It probably is one of the most famous passages in all of Shakespeare. And although it is fictional, you know, it's a play, they're Shakespeare's words, not Henry's. Nevertheless, I feel like it's so famous, it's worth reading out. Okay, so here's the text. It's Act 4, Scene 3 in the English camp. And my reading will be somewhere between Branner and Olivier, somewhere between the two. So, enter Gloucester, Bedford, Exeter, Salisbury and Westmoreland. And Gloucester says, "Where is the king?" And Bedford says, "The king himself is rode to view their battle." Westmoreland, "Of fighting men, they have 80,000. Exeter, "There's 5 to 1. Besides, they are all fresh." Salisbury, "God's arms strike with us. 'Tis a fearful odds. God's be with you, princes all. I'll to my charge. If we no more meet till we meet in heaven, then joyfully my noble Lord Bedford, my dear Lord Gloucester, and my good Lord Exeter, and my kind kinsmen, warriors all, adieu." Bedford, "Farewell, good Salisbury, and good luck go with thee." Exeter, "Farewell, kind lord. Fight valiantly today. And yet I do thee wrong to mind thee of it, for thou art famed of the firm truth of valour. Salisbury exits. Bedford says, he is as full of valour as of kindness, princely in both. And Westmoreland says, oh, that we now had here but 1/10,000 of those men of England that do no work today. And then King Harry enters, and this is the famous speech. He says, what's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marked to die, we are enough to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men the greater share of honour. God's will, I pray thee wish not one man more. By Jove, I am not covetous for gold, nor care I who doth feed upon my cost. It yearns me not if men my garments wear. Such outward things dwell not in my desires. But if it be a sin to covet honour, I am the most offending soul alive. No, faith, my cuz, wish not a man from England. God's peace, I would not lose so great an honour as one man more, methinks, would share from me. For the best hope I have, oh, do not wish one man more. Rather, proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he who hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named, and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his friends and say, tomorrow is St. Crispian. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispian's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispian Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day until the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. And be he never so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen of England now abed shall think themselves accursed that they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap while any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. End quote. Okay, so that fabled night of the 24th to the 25th of October, Ian Mortimer writes, the night of the 24th to 25th of October, 1415, cannot have been easy for anyone anywhere near Agincourt, whether they were French or English, for the Englishmen camped in the tents in the orchards and gardens of Maisoncelles, and for their lords and masters in the houses and barns. There was the sheer nervous anticipation of the following day. Few could have slept well. Some were still suffering from dysentery. As they lay and sat there, listening to the pounding of the rain, if they were not actually feeling it, soaked through their clothes, most would have believed that on the following day they would die. Men who survived the battle, but who were captured and could not afford to pay a ransom, would be killed, normally with a knife through the windpipe or an axe blow through the skull. It was being said that the French were casting lots for which English lords they were going to take prisoner, such was their confidence. The rain was the least of their worries, their lack of food, their tiredness and fear. Tomorrow everything would be over, the whole hellish episode. For the Frenchmen, things could not have been much easier. The rain was a bother. They had to go into the villages and take what straw and hay they could find to try and soak up the mud where they were camping. Many men had been billeted in villages until now, and so lacked any tents or other shelter, and so grew depressed as they sat waiting in the heavy rain. This rain will be all important for the battle itself the following day. They were also tired, having tracked the English army for 2 weeks, and having had several hard days riding in order to cut off the English advance. They too were hungry and miserable. They had been forced to live off the land and had had to requisition or steal food from their own people. Groups of them had regularly confronted the English and had been wounded. Large portions of their army were absent. The Duke of Orleans seems to have caught up with the rest of the army during the night or first thing in the morning, so presumably he was riding through the dire weather. But that meant their overall commander was tired and unfamiliar with the territory as well as the troops. And where were the other ducal companies? Where was the Duke of Brittany? Where were the Duke of Anjou's men? Where was the Duke of Brabant? Where was the Duke of Lorraine? Where was John the Fearless and his son, the Count of Charlois? Henry was lodged in a small house in Maisoncelles. His night was no doubt spent in prayer, in part at least. Everything he had worked for was to be put to the test on the morrow. Every decision he had made was likewise to be tested, But most of all, his faith was on trial. If God was not on his side after all, then tomorrow he would be a prisoner of the King of France. And in his absence, his enjoyment of the throne of England would depend entirely on the loyalty of his brothers. How loyal would they be after he had forsaken the advice of his brother and heir, Thomas, in undertaking this march across France? The very reason he was here in France was to prove his right to the throne of England by demonstrating it was God's will that he should be King of France. If he lost this battle, and many hundreds of men, he stood to lose not just his claim on the French throne, but the security of his English title too. He had staked everything on victory. It was all or nothing. In this light, one has to give Henry credit for holding his nerve and providing such controlled leadership, especially in the wake of his own ill health. Few other men could have done it in such appalling circumstances, but he did not let up for a moment. In line with his strict discipline on the march, he ordered that the whole camp was to remain silent throughout the night. Men-at-arms making a noise were to have their horses and armour confiscated. Archers and servants who were not silent were to have an ear cut off. This rule of silence served two purposes. It encouraged prayerfulness, and it permitted careful attention to the sounds of the night. Had the English been making a clamour, and with the rain falling so heavily, it would have been very easy for a French sortie to make a sudden night attack and cause confusion and panic throughout the English army. The two camps were no more than 1,200 yards apart. One source says that their front lines were as close as 250 paces. Because of the danger, Henry also ordered his men to build bonfires by which to keep watch through the night. The moon was now in its last quarter. With the rain clouds above, there was virtually no moonlight. Nevertheless, it appears that the Count of Richemont advanced to the English lines with 2,000 men and came close enough to be noticed and attacked by archers before he withdrew. Henry also sent out men to reconnoitre the land. Despite the darkness and the rain, it was worth getting to know as much as possible about the site of the forthcoming battle. End quote. So in Shakespeare's play, they have a show that the French are playing dice and getting drunk. But the way Ian Mortimer tells it is that a lot of the, at least normal men in the French, on the French side, would have had almost as much of a miserable time of it as the English. Although at least not thinking they're certainly going to face death in the morning. Shakespeare also has a touch of Harry in the night where he goes round to his men, occasionally sort of arguing with them about the king's rights. There's some touching bits where one of the men talks about how there'll be many a grieving woman and child in England come tomorrow when their menfolk are cut down. But others say how much they love the king and they wouldn't be anywhere else. But there's a great bit in also in the play, the chorus opening that act, where we're told, "Now entertain conjecture of a time when creeping murmur and pouring dark fills the wide vessel of the universe. From camp to camp, through the foul womb of night, the hum of their army stilly sounds, that the fixed sentinels almost receive the secret whispers of each other's watch. Fire answers fire, and through their paly flames each battle sees the other's umbered face. Steed threatens steed in high and boastful neighs, piercing the knight's dull ear. And from the tents, accomplishing the knights, with busy hammers closing rivets up, give dreadful note of preparation. The country cocks do crow, the clocks do toll, and the third hour of drowsy morning name. Proud of their numbers and securing soul, the confident and overlusty French do the low-rated English play at dice, and chide the crippled, tardy, gated knight, who, like a foul and ugly witch, doth limp so tediously away. The poor condemned English, like sacrifices, by their watchful fires, sit patiently, and inly ruminate the morning's danger, and their gesture, sad, investing lank, lean cheeks and war-worn coats, presenteth them unto the gazing moon so many horrid ghosts. Oh, now, who will behold the royal captain of this ruined band, walking from watch to watch, from tent to tent? Let him cry praise and glory on his head, for forth he goes and visits all his hosts." We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.